You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Bernadette Peters.
Hey, I'm Anissa Foles.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Fergie L. Philippe.
Hi, I'm Eliza Ullman.
Hola, soy Florencia Cuenca.
Y yo soy Jaime Lozano.
Hi, this is L. Morgan Lee.
It's Alex Brightman from Broadway and beyond.
Hi, this is Joe Iconis.
And this is Lauren Marquez.
Y estás escuchando.
And you're listening to
B-Way Show.
B-Way Show.
B-Way
Show.
The podcast.
Hey, friends. Welcome to B-Way Show, the podcast. Your home for theater conversations from a passionate Broadway fan and reporter. I'm your host, Shoshana, and I want to start off by emphasizing Black Lives Matter, period.
Show must go on.
This week's guest is Abe Goldfarb. Abe is best known for being in the original Broadway cast of Beetlejuice. He originated ensemble roles like The Mover and Neighbor and understudies Beetlejuice, Adam, Otho, and Maxie Dean. Abe directed The Horror at Gallery K and has been on screen and done voice work in When in Rome, Pokemon, and so much more. Get ready for his incredible rendition of Sweet Transvestite in this episode, and then guess what? We're making this a two-parter. It's showtime! Enjoy part one of our conversation from September 9th, recorded for my live YouTube series, The Show Must Go On, Line. Enjoy.
We are live. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Show Must Go On, Line. Today's guest is Abe Goldfarb. How are you doing today?
I'm doing so much better now that I'm speaking with you, Shoshana.
You are so lovely. Thank you. The feelings are mutual. There are some people who you just have this feeling like, oh, this is going to be fun. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be fun.
I will try not to suck at being interviewed. I'll do my best.
Sucks yes. Get ready for the Beetlejuice, all of it, because...
Oh, I'm ready. I'm so ready.
I love the show. I saw it 3 times on Broadway.
Wow. Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Including on Halloween.
You were there when like 80% of the audience was in costume. Oh, Haley St. James. What's up? There in the con.
Big fan of Haley.
Oh, yeah. Same. Great, terrific writer and a huge fan of Coldplay.
If you want to hear about Coldplay, go follow Haley St. James.
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Excellent, excellent. And on that note, we see all of your comments. Hello, Judy. Hello, Amanda. Big shout out. If you have questions, just comment below. We will get to them throughout the interview. We'll kind of just sprinkle them in, if you will. And it's always so fun to see all of your faces and names. Faces and names.
Yeah. So you saw the show 3 times, including Halloween.
Beetlejuice.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny because Beetlejuice was one of those shows where, to this day, have never seen the movie.
Really? Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, it depends on the generation. I mean, for people my age, I'm 41. And okay. So for people my age, it's generally just one of those things that you've seen. But definitely one of the coolest things about the show, which I just love. I love the show. One of the coolest things about it is that it has become the sort of canonical definitive Beetlejuice to a certain segment of the population,
yes.
Which is it's very humbling to be a part of that legacy.
Amazing. Yeah, it's really fun to hear and see like all the fans and see how the ages range, because a lot of shows, I guess this is what I was thinking, like you have maybe like this target demographic or this, but you've got like the younger generation who only know of it as the musical, probably through TikTok, which is crazy.
Yes. This was, I'll tell you something. I started noticing it a couple months after we opened, because TikTok didn't really explode until really like the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like June or July. It was, I'm pretty sure, after the Tony's performance.
Okay, that makes sense.
I believe. The Tony's performance went viral, and that was rad. But what really, really, and I was the mopping football player in the Tony's performance in the bowels of Radio City. But I remember that TikTok started throwing up all of these lip syncs. And one of our producers, Mark Kaufman, who works with Warner Brothers Theatrical, I remember mentioning it to him.
Yeah.
Because he would hang out in the theater because he was as big a fan as any of us. And I was like, man, have you started paying attention to this thing, TikTok? And he was like, oh, yeah, we're going to do like a partnership with them or something. And I was like, good, because all the fans are there. They're all on there. It's astounding.
That's amazing to hear that the connection was there, which doesn't always happen, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of time the young fans, and they're like, this is what we want. And then the producers or director, or, you know, whoever might be calling the shots at that moment, they're like, that's cool, but this is what we're doing.
Right. No, there was always a sense of, well, I think anything, I know for a fact, Warner Brothers developed the show because it was a huge hit movie and it's like iconic.
Yes.
It's intellectual property that enough people would know about that you could get, you know, asses in seats right off the bat. But then you have like a whole job after you've got the first bunch of asses in seats, which is how do you convince people that this is a worthwhile take, especially when tickets cost what they cost on Broadway.
Right.
And it was a long road to figuring out A, what the show was at its core, and B, who the audience was.
Mm.
Things really clarified down in Washington, D.C., and during our previews in New York, and then clarified even further when the kids took over. I mean, the kids are amazing to me. These are the kids who totally trolled, you know, Trump's rally in Tulsa. You know, the TikTok generation is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I love them.
I love them so much. Yes. I love everything about them. And they've really taken like the political stance and their own take on so many things. And they're like, I'm not going to be told what to say. And
well, yeah, no, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. These are the people who are going to save us.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And okay. Also, just as a heads up, y'all, I see your comments, as I mentioned. Also, I see them better with my glasses, which makes a circle in this ring light. So I'm going to take them off for most of the interview, but get to them with the interview later. So just in case if you see me going like this, like a grandma, I have astigmatism. And
same. Me too. We have so much in common.
So much. So let's just start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. And what's your origin story? What got you into theater?
Oh, well, gosh. I grew up on Long Island in Port Washington on the North Shore, which I hated. And I got, as soon as I was out of junior high, I was out of Port Washington. I went to high school on a farm in Vermont, a place called the Putney School.
Wow.
And I was part of this effort to renovate a barn that was sort of a derelict barn and turn it into the theater for the school because, you know, they were using like the assembly hall, stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, this barn got turned around and fixed up and it became the theater. Now they have like a really expensive, gorgeous, you know, sort of theaterplex at the Putney School. But this was the first step. And in high school, I was, you know, a theater nerd.
Good.
And I knew that I wanted to do theater. I was less interested in film. I was much more interested in theater. And, you know, my parents were big stage people. My dad, he claimed that he was a bad actor, but I never saw evidence. So I can't begin to say. But he was delighted that I was getting into it. And I wound up auditioning for theater schools in the UK. I got into Marymount Manhattan for a Bachelor of Fine Arts. And I was also going to study religious psychology. And then, while I was in the run-up to the school year starting, I just, for the shits of it, went to the UK and auditioned for, I think it was RADA, Lambda, Central, and the Bristol Old Vic. And I didn't expect much. Like, I think I got a call back at RADA, and then I got a call back at the Old Vic, and then I heard nothing. And my first day of classes at Marymount Manhattan, I got a piece of paper on my desk which said, "Call Mother. Urgent family business, not death."
So, good disclaimer.
I was honestly great. That's terrific because I'm very neurotic. And so just having like PS, not death. So yeah, this was September 1997. And I called my mom and she said, "Are you sitting down? You're in the Old Vic." And the Old Vic did a 3-year program that took 13 kids. And so I did this super intensive 3-year study where it was like 8:45 to 7, 5 days a week. and built up a powerful tolerance for alcohol and clubbing. And fell in love with a Welsh lass for a minute. And that was sort of, the old Vic was the best education I could possibly have asked for. It was just total immersion, hard work, really hard work. I've actually never had to work harder than I did at the old Vic. Probably until Beetlejuice. But it was good. It put me in good stead. You know, the first day at the first dance class, we had this dance teacher named Gail Gordon, who is an incredible person. This hard drinking northerner who she was a contortionist with the circus. Ooh. Which is a completely unfair in terms of like teaching a bunch of little dinglings how to dance.
Yeah.
And the first day she had us go down into a squat for a half hour. Like, I mean, take a half hour going down into a squat. The most. But yeah, it's full. It's like a military experience. But yeah, the first year was all classes. And then the second year was touring shows. We did the Nativity. I was Joseph, the one Jew in the cast.
Hey, go Jews.
Right. We did the Nativity. We did, unfortunately, Hiawatha, which starring a bunch of pasty Caucasians was, I'm going to say hashtag problematic. Fair. And then we did Charles Dickens' Hard Times, which was a 3-hour long adaptation where we all had heavy makeup. And also we were basically the crew. We had a 2-ton set that we had to move around. We had like, I think, 30 lights we had to install. And that was the real boot camp. So that by the time you got to year three, when you were just doing in-house productions, it was actually like a holiday. Because you're just like, oh, I can just get up and walk to the theater.
Right.
Like, that's fine. Wow. Instead of touring around the southwest of England on like 3 hours of sleep for 6 weeks. It was really intense. I loved it.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Hilarious and hard, but amazing.
Very. Yeah. And then I came back to New York and had no success through my 20s as an actor. So that was cool. I loved that for me.
I love that journey for you.
Yes. But yeah, after a few years of really just big nothing, I did a really shitty production of a not so great play. And a friend of one of the cast members came out to our closing night party and told me exactly how terrible the show was. And I had to agree. And we basically just shot the shit, talked a little, and I got very, very drunk and I sang Fix You by Coldplay.
It always comes back to Coldplay.
It always comes back to Coldplay. And the guy, the friend of the cast member was like, you know, you can sing. And I was like, I know. And it was the worst. And he said, listen, I'm a burlesque host. I host burlesque shows and I'm doing a thing where I'm running for burlesque mayor. And I feel like this character should have like an embarrassing relative who fucks up their mayoral run. So this guy was Johnny Porkpie, who's a sweetheart and a dear friend. And I was Keith Porkpie, his bastard half cousin. And so I started doing guest appearances in these burlesque shows. And then I started getting asked to host shows on my own. And I was like, I can't be Keith Porkpie because he's Johnny Porkpie. And I was like, okay, bastard Keith. That's my my character name. And so I've been hosting burlesque shows as Bastard Keith now for since 2006.
Wow.
Yeah. And that kind of, that's actually led to pretty much everything career-wise. Like I've gotten into a lot of rooms where me being a downtown scuzzball art kid is very valuable. It turns out to be a terrific hook, you know.
That just goes to show, people talk about like, oh, this journey, or I'm supposed to do that, or, oh, we have to go specifically like ABC. But no, because when you try to play by the rules and just do what you're quote unquote supposed to do, that's not.
You're not supposed to do anything. Mm-hmm. Like you've just got to make stuff, you know? Yeah. I mean, I wound up pulling a decent paycheck as a burlesque host eventually, you know, and I got to work with people who were amazing. I got to travel the world. It took me over to Vancouver. It took me to Helsinki. I mean, I did a month run in a cirque show, like a bizarre adult cirque show over in Helsinki. It put me up in an apartment and like paid me to do a job. Like it was astounding. And I do cartoon voices as well. I'm on Pokemon or rather I was. My characters have come to the end of their run, and they're moving, I think, the recordings out to LA. But the reason that I got in the room for that was because one of the producers of Pokemon was a huge fan of burlesque and enjoyed my work and was like, listen, do you want to have an audition? You know? And tell me if I'm babbling. You have questions. I'm like, brr.
This is perfect. This is exactly what you want. Yes.
Great. And also it was very much the foundation of what I brought into the room for the Beetlejuice audition.
So how did you hear about that? And then what was that process like?
Well, I have a wonderful manager, Naomi Kohlstein, who's with Bohemia Group. And I was really burned out.
Yeah.
On musical theater. Like, I was just not having fun. And I was starting, my work was really becoming more acting in commercials and doing voiceovers and doing burlesque. And I didn't book the workshop. I got called in to audition for the workshop. Then I got called in to audition for the DC tryout. And I was like, man, I don't know. I just feel like I'm done. Like, it's just not fun anymore. And Naomi was like, you're doing it. You're doing this audition. So I went and I read the materials and I was like, oh, this is burlesque hosting. Like, Beetlejuice is an MC.
Yes.
And there's a kind of funny that's Broadway funny. And that's not the kind of funny that I necessarily go for. Mm-hmm. And that's not to insult it. It's just not my sensibility.
Totally.
But there is a kind of funny on Broadway that's, I think, quite safe because, you know, you have to appeal to a very broad number of people. Mm-hmm. And what struck me in the Beetlejuice material was that it was not playing to that at all. It was, especially in the Washington, D.C. version.
I have heard.
But it was skewing very dark, very twisted, very, you know, very genuinely funny. And it made sense later when I met Brightman because, like, it's so tailored to him. Mm-hmm. And he is one of the most naturally funny human beings I have ever encountered in my life. So, yeah, I listened at the door to see how people were delivering it all. Because, well, I was like, I just want to know if I'm crazy, if I'm going to go in there and just tank it. Everyone else was delivering it fairly traditionally, beautifully. And I just went in and was sort of very abrasive and foolish. And it worked. And I got called back and they gave me, you know, because I was going in for the ensemble and for understudy roles. Mm. And so then I was reasonably confident in my Beetlejuice. But then they started handing me like Adam Maitland, Charles Dietz, Otho, Maxie Dean. And I had a good handle on most of them. And Otho changed a lot between not just the workshop in D.C., but between D.C. and New York. And I thought, well, I need to make at least one choice that could cost me this job. So I did it with Otho. I was like, I'm going to do basically like James Mason meets the Moonanites from Aqua Teen, but like really queer.
As it always should be.
And it worked out. It got laughs. I was very grateful for that. And then we had a final round of callbacks. And, you know, I arrived and the hallway was full of the most astonishingly pornographically beautiful people I've ever seen in my life. Just like stunning human beings. And I was like, oh, fuck, I'm not booking this at all. And then I saw a bunch of like, you know, character guys sitting in the corner. And I was like, ah, yes.
One of us.
This is my corner. And I did fine in the singing. I did fine in the acting. And I totally shit the bed in the tap. The tap was a disaster. I'm not a tap dancer. And I thought, well, that's that. And then a few weeks later, I was told that I was on a very strong hold for the show. And I thought, well, that's that. I'm definitely not booking it. And then I got the call that I was doing it. And we did. DC was the most fun. DC was so much fun. And I understand why it had to change. Like, I do. But I miss a lot of the more chaotic, horrifying stuff. For those of you who don't know, DC was so much filthier and so much more violent. Maxie Dean died in DC.
Really?
Yeah. Beetlejuice, instead of summoning up the big puppet at the end of Act One, Beetlejuice conjured basically a bunch of murder clowns out of the floorboards who dragged Maxie Dean down into the ground and like buzzsawed his limbs off.
Oh my goodness.
So like Maxine Dean was left holding like a bloody stump of Maxie's arm, you know, before she runs off stage screaming. And Beetlejuice, instead of let's all get naked in the whole being dead thing to it, was show me your penis. It was just really, really show me your penis. Ah, worth a try. And there was also the pig dick. There was a big old cock on the pig.
No.
Yeah, the pig had a curly, a gigantic cock.
So not kosher.
Waggling, not kosher at all, just waggling around. And Leslie Kritzer, who is a comedy demon, made sure most nights that it like flopped into her mouth as she was fighting off the pig. She was like, oh! And also the Girl Scout almost definitely died in DC.
That makes sense.
Well, because she collapsed with a heart attack in the middle of the song and her body was just on stage for most of Beautiful Sound. And then at the end, she jumps up and goes, I'm alive. My heart's stronger than I ever imagined. And Beetlejuice just goes, go get those cookies, and hands out knives to all the clones. And then they finish that Beautiful Sound. And it was like, then later in the show, the clones come back eating the cookies and laughing. The implication being they absolutely stabbed up the Girl Scout.
Such a different storyline and plotline. I love this.
So different. And in DC, of course, you did not have Miss Argentina. In DC, the Netherworld was, they got welcomed immediately by Juno.
Wow.
Who back then was called Mrs. Shoggoth, which is sort of a Lovecraft reference.
Oh.
But it was changed to Juno for New York because Juno is the character that people, people know. But basically, she welcomed all the characters to the Netherworld and gave them a brief orientation performance by a dead boy band called Boy Inferno. Who had died in a plane crash and who were like covered in horrible burns and did this full on 90s boy band song called Everything Is Meh, which was all about how in the Netherworld everything's like fine.
I
like,
need
whatever.
To see this. What?
It's, I would never in a million years suggest searching for a bootleg. In a million years.
It could never happen.
If it fell in your lap, watch it, because that number is fucking absolute chaos. But so we did the show down there, and it was like a summer camp experience. It was the most fun. And none of the ensemble had contracts for New York.
Wow.
We knew that we were going to be opening at the Winter Garden, but we didn't know if we had the show. And so I spent the winter basically not knowing if I had a job. I got called back in to audition again for it. And by the way, I must say, the reason that I was in there at all is Alex Timbers. Because he saw me for a bunch of shows over the years, like Peter and the Starcatcher, back when Roger Rees was alive, rest his soul. Mm. So I got to audition for Timbers and Roger Rees. He brought me in for an ensemble part in Rocky. I didn't get that. He brought me in for a role in, I think it was called Up Here, which was a show he did out in La Jolla, and I didn't book that. And the mistake, I think, that a lot of actors make is if a director keeps calling me in and doesn't cast me, he must not like me. And it's like, no, he keeps calling you in.
Right.
Keep going in. And Timbers is a genius. I mean, it's all just chaos and chance. And I'm very lucky. Things came along at the right time. But so I wound up waiting until January before I knew that I was in the show.
Wow.
And a lot of the other ensemble had already gotten the call. But I found out later that the reason that it took so long was because the coverage for understudies was very different. And so they brought in like way more coverage and they needed to sort out who was doing what. And Timbers, bless him, is just one of the kindest people I've ever met. And he himself just like came up to me while we were on break and was like, hey, just so you know, here's why it took so long for you to find out. We're really sorry about it. And he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to do that at all. He's just one of the warmest, most generous souls I've encountered in theater.
Wow. That's amazing. It's always nice to hear those stories.
It's very rare that someone is as visionary as he is and as considerate and sweet.
Yay.
So, aww, yeah.
That is great. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
when I see understudies and swings, I just like, it blows my mind that you can have all of these different characters in your brain ready to go at a moment's notice. Sometimes you find out that day.
20 minutes before.
Intermission.
Maxie Dean, I found out 20 minutes before the show when I went on for him.
What goes through your mind?
Shit! Well, you know, your heart goes throb, and then you're like, okay, what do I need to know? like in terms of tracking what changes for me, because I'm doing my full ensemble track plus this role. Yeah, you don't like, because, you know, Danny Rotigliano and Kelvin Munlow, who did Otho, they were both also part of the ensemble for a lot of that first act.
Right.
You know, and second. So, you know, I had to just be like, okay, I come off stage after this number, then I have to go change my makeup, change my costume, get the wig on, come back down for this. And then I have to do this intermission. It's just like Jenga, you know, you sort of have to reorganize it in your head. And I found out 20 minutes before the show, and I found Brooke, our dance captain, who is astounding. I don't have a bad word to say about anybody involved in this show.
Yay!
You are going to get absolutely zero dish.
Perfect.
There's no tea to spill. It's just an extraordinary, extraordinary bunch of people. But Brooke took me through really quickly, because I'd only rehearsed Maxie Dean once. And she took me through the dance for Deo, and I was like, okay, great. And it all worked out.
What?
Yeah.
That's bonkers.
It's totally insane. But yeah, we were split tracking too. So like, you know, I was doing my track and then in the middle, Danny, and then me for the rest of the show. And then I think it was Eric Johnson who did the sort of fill-in bits on Danny's track. And then like for me, I think he was one of the lawyers while I was Maxie Dane. I'd never understudied for anything in my life. This was my first time doing it. And I'm understudying, you know, five roles, including two leads, you know. And so that was really scary. That was a lot of hard work. That was genuinely like unnerving.
That really video you posted of you as Beetlejuice. Thank you.
Oh, you got it.
That's yes. Amazing.
So I put in rehearsal for like a couple weeks before we shut down because of COVID. But you know, Rachel Botter, one of our stage manager, was like, just so you know, like you're gonna go on, like you're gonna be put on the schedule because now I know that you can do this. And I was like, okay. So had COVID not happened, I would have gone on for Beach, and it would have been a beautiful challenge.
That beautiful sound would have been music to our ears.
Yeah.
So, all right. I feel like there are a few ways I want to go with this. But first, it's really cool that every Beetlejuice is unique. That it's not just, here's Alex Brightman, now be Alex Brightman.
They didn't want that. They did not want it. That's why you get Will Blum being astounding in the role and nothing like him.
Yes. So when you're going through, I mean, because you're already understudying an ensemble of these other characters, then you're acting with Alex on a daily basis, but you're also crafting your own Beetlejuice. What's that process like for you?
The process is, it's two parts. One is, what does he want in every scene? And just like try and be true to that, because you can dress it up with a whole bunch of mannerisms, but it's not going to give it clarity. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to sort of find a clear trajectory. And then the other thing is, what's some shit I can do that makes me laugh?
Yes.
Because, I mean, that's, weirdly enough, that's the salient thing. Not what Brightman did with the role, which was iconic, but the fact that I think so much of it was just engineered from a desire to amuse himself.
And you can tell, like, I mean, obviously it's acting, yes, but also there's joy in it.
So much joy. A genuine love of performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So when practicing or doing the put-in, are there moments that are especially scary, like the famous line?
Oh, well, gosh. Wait, which famous? You can't say the famous line. Is which one? Is it Showtime? It's Showtime is fine. That was the one scene I totally fucked up in the in my put-in. I fucked up two little technical cues in there. And I was like, well, it's halfway through and I've shit the bed. But we recovered and we got through it. And then I knew what I had to do. But no, if there's anything scary, I'd actually say it's the big dance number and beautiful sound. Because there's so many bodies on stage. And I am not a person of modest dimensions. I'm a large, lanky man. And Alex is not as tall as me. And so I really had to modulate my movement so as not to whack into anybody. You know, because it is being on stage during that beautiful sound. I know it looks crazy out there. It looks 20 times crazier on stage in the middle of it. And you're like, I have to go upstage of that guy and not downstage of her, or I'm going to get fucking clobbered and I need to get out of this way because Mateo's about to jump off the table. It is terrifying.
There's so much athleticism in just that number alone.
Yeah. Well, that number is the showpiece dance-wise. That's the one where like they pulled out all the stops.
Newsies dance break.
Precisely.
I love a Newsies dance break.
Who Among Us, etc.
Amanda says understudies and swings are 100% superheroes, and I agree.
Oh man. Oh, it is nice to find out that people appreciate the stuff we do. You know, I mean, and I was working with a couple of superstars in there. You know, I mean, Will, Sean Montgomery, Natalie Ellis, God, I mean, Kim Sava was just a force, you know, and our swings like Zach and Eric. I mean, these were just, and I mean, Brooke wound up swinging in for a few shows.
Wow.
You know, I mean, just incredible stuff. I mean, I have so much respect for it. And I honestly always felt like an intruder. I felt like I didn't belong because like I'm, as I say, like a scuzzy downtown art boy. And everyone else is so disciplined and so experienced and so storied. And so the bar was very high and I felt a genuine responsibility. I was like, don't let these people down because they are putting in the hours and you got to put them in too. And you've got to be there for them the way they are for you. It's all a fucking trust fall, you know?
Right. Yeah, it is. And it is such a downtown show on Broadway.
It really, I mean, the DC version, you straight up, the DC version was a $20 million downtown show. Wow. The Broadway version was definitely like PG-13. but still edgier than most Broadway.
100%. I mean, the fact that, and it's funny because I was just re-listening to my interview with Alex Braitman because the episode on B-Way Show, the podcast, dropped today. And we were talking about how creepy old guy being in the show, you wouldn't necessarily think that that would be allowed. But I appreciate the honesty and the self-reflection of, no, we see what we're doing. It's not cool. We're going to call it out. And now we can continue on with the show.
That's correct. You know, down in DC, it was trickier because the show had been so filthy up till then that it was harder, I think, for people to see the irony of the number.
I see.
Because the show had been really rejoicing in filth up until that point. But, you know, but I understand, like, it really context matters so much, tone and context. And so a creepy old guy in DC, I think a lot of people were like, this is an ode to pedophilia. And it I mean, we got a lot of nasty words down there about that. And in New York, it made more sense because it was like Lydia Dietz has a scheme. She's going to carry off that scheme and she's going to scam the biggest scam artist in the universe.
Yes.
And so there was more, it was more delineated. The irony of all of it was clearer. And I think like Eddie Perfect said it very well. Oh God, Eddie, what a lord. And by the way, we talked about how funny the show is. Anthony King and Scott Brown are princes among men.
Brilliant.
And also when it became clear that Beetlejuice was going to be canonically queer, Scott was really, he got a phone call from, I can't remember what gay magazine it was, but they were like, we're hearing rumbles. This was during previews that Beetlejuice is queer in your show. And Scott's response was, Beetlejuice respects no binaries, not even life and death.
Yes.
But Eddie talked about creepy old guy, and he said the thing was, what happens when you give a creepy old guy exactly what he wants? And once you sort of frame it like that, with Lydia Dietz absolutely at the steering wheel for all of this, and the show not being, I think, in some senses, completely driven by Beetlejuice, Lydia's emotional life was clearer by the time we got to New York. And they were much more co-leads by the time New York happened, which was just beautiful writing. It was great in DC. It was pristine in New York. And yeah, it just all made sense.
Yeah.
And it worked. It's a real tightrope walk. Like, how is this going to play?
Right. Well, yeah, it definitely. Anyway,
you were saying.
No, it did. the whole show just felt like this piece was meant to be there. And like, this guy knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Goddamn, like,
I love that joke.
Right. It's so funny because even though you know it's happening and then it happens again and again, it's so funny.
It's better because it's better because you know it's coming.
Mm.
It's the whole Hitchcock thing of like, I think the principles of suspense and comedy are very similar. Like, you know that there's a bomb under the table. Like, when's it going to go off? You can't just say it twice. There's got to be a third one to close the circle.
It always has to be Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
That's right.
Beetlejuice.
Exactly.
Haley saying non-binary King Beetlejuice.
We do stand and then be king.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So this feels like a great opportunity to tell y'all, start thinking of your questions, write them down, get them in your noggin, and maybe we can get a special performance.
Maybe. Now or later?
Now if it works for you.
Let's do it. So I've always been a fairly enormous dweeb, especially for Rocky Horror. So I'm just going to really quickly sing. My voice is a little out of practice, so this might be terrible. This one, Sweet Transvestite. Let's give it a shot. How'd you do? I see you've met my faithful handyman. He's just a little brought down because when you knocked, he thought you were the handyman. Don't get stronger by the way I look. Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. Let me show you around, maybe play your sound. You look like you're both pretty groovy. But if you want something visual that's not too abysmal, we could take in an old Steve Reeves movie. I'm glad we caught you at home. Could we use your phone? We're both in a bit of a hurry. Right. We'll just stay where we are, then go back to the car. We don't want to be any worry. Well, you got caught with a flat whale. How about that? Well, babies, don't you panic. By the light of the night, it'll all seem all right. I'll get you a satanic mechanic. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. Why don't you stay for the night? Or maybe a bite? I could show you my favorite obsession. You see, I've been making a man with blonde hair and a tan, and he's good for relieving my tension. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. I'm
I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. So, come up to the lab and see what's on the slab. I see you shiver with anticipation. But maybe the rain is really to blame. So I'll remove the cause. But not the symptom!
Yeah!
Okay. All right.
Woo!
I have not really sung for a while. That's nice. That was fun. Thank you for letting me be a little Chaponi.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Haley saying, I'm living and I feel that just the same right in my soul.
Oh my. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Also saying, Tim Curry would be so proud of this performance.
Please.
so good. Anna Louise saying, Abe as Frankenfurter is everything I didn't know I wanted or needed, but I'm so happy right now.
I would die. I would die. And I'm not the obvious casting for Frankenfurter, but thank you.
But now we've seen it, and now we need it.
But yes, thank you for indulging me.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I love that song. I love that score. Actually, if you like Rocky Horror, you should also check out Shock Treatment, ooh, which was the non-sequel sequel to Rocky Horror, which came out in the early 80s.
Nice.
And it was made by the exact same creative team, and it bombed spectacularly. And it's about Brad and Janet coming back to Denton, and the town has been transformed into a giant TV station, and like everyone just lives in the TV station, and it actually eerily predicted reality television. I also think Shock Treatment has a better score than Rocky Horror. I just think Shock Treatment has better songs.
Wow. Heard here first.
But yes, Shock Treatment.
Shock Treatment.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. I love Rocky Horror. I went to the University of Maryland, go Terps.
And I assume that's short for Turpentines. I don't know anything about sports, but go on.
Let's stick with that. And
yes, the Maryland Turpentines. Everyone's favorite sports ball team.
Sports ball. I feel
it's
like
it's going to be a grand dunk. Anyway, so you went to University of Maryland.
Now I'm just picturing the athletes running across the stage in the football netherworld scene.
Mm.
Good times. Good times.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
So at Maryland, they would have the, you know, Halloween showing of Rocky Horror, and we would all get dressed up. And then I wanted to do that in New York. One of my friends was actually in a production there. Yeah. And now that we like can't go out anywhere, I'm thinking like, can we all just have like this virtual Rocky Horror Halloween extravaganza?
That sounds like the most fun. I love that. I love it.
Let's 100%. Make it happen. Mm-hmm.
Let's do a thing. Let's do a thing. Yes. I'd love to help. I'd love to be a part of it.
I love. Mm, so happy right now. Excellent. Excellent.
Thanks for listening to the 8th episode of BYU Show, the podcast. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and review so you can be a spy on the inside for future episodes. This is part one of my conversation with Abe Goldfarb, so come back next time to hear the rest of his story. Plus, let's make this Rocky Horror Picture Show party happen. Do the time warp with us on Halloween, 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. # Rocky Horror Picture Show, that's SHO, to join the fun. Thanks as always to Kyle Braxton, aka Geddon, for these awesome beats, Jelani Remy for the beautiful intro riff, and Chelsea Hill, aka Illustrating Diva, for the cool cover art. If this was your jam, you can become a Showtron. Head over to patreon.com/BYUShow. We do weekly trivia and monthly video chats. It's a fun time. Come check it out. Don't throw away your shot to have your voice heard in the election of 2020. Vote for change. Vote for humanity. Vote for a better future. Biden-Harris 2020. We don't know the future of live theater or when Broadway will be back, but we do know it's on all of us to get through this pandemic. Wear a mask, be safe, and let's take care of ourselves. We'll see you at the show.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.